It's time for Twig This Week in Google. Stacey Higginbotham is here. We're also joined by Joan Donovan from Data and Society. We're going to talk about VPN filter, that botnet that the Russians created. What might they be up to and why you should reboot your router? Mary Meeker's State of the Internet slideshow. We'll discuss each and every one of all her 294 slides. I promise we won't. And targeting Shaq. It's all coming up next on Twig.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by Cachefly. CacheFly.com.
This is Twig. This Week in Google, episode 459, recorded Wednesday, May 30th, 2018. Status update, terror. This Week in Google is brought to you by Tres Puntas, freshly roasted gourmet coffee shipped directly to you. Visit trespuntas.com/twig and use the code TWIG to save 20% off every bag of coffee in your subscription. It's time for Twig This Week in Google, the show we cover whatever the heck we want to cover. Sometimes Google, usually a little Google thrown in, but thanks to Stacey Higginbotham, a lot of IoT stuff. Stacey on IoT.com. Hi, Stacey. Welcome back. We missed you.
Hello. I am happy to be here.
But now that you're here, Jeff's gone, so you can't win. You can't win. But the good news is we've replaced Jeff with somebody even more wonderful. Joan Donovan is here. We always like to get Joan on. She is a researcher at dataandsociety.net. Her official area is media manipulation. Love it.
Yep.
Hi, Joan.
Business is booming.
Business is good.
Yep. Every day.
you actually have a good article that came out earlier this year. I guess this is one of your reports on algorithmic accountability. And it's funny because I've just this morning was thinking about the problem with the algorithm. We were talking about how, gosh darn it, they ruined Instagram because it's no longer chronological. It's algorithmic. And and then I think it was Anthony Nielsen, one of our producers, who said, well, the real problem is companies now optimize for engagement, optimize for time spent, not optimize for user happiness. They're not trying to make users happy. They're just trying to optimize for time spent. We were talking about how YouTube now, if you subscribe, the subscriptions are all broken. You can't, you go to your YouTube subscription, you don't get notifications. Your subscriptions, part of them are in the subscription list. Some of them aren't. Mostly it's recommendations. It's all algorithmic.
Yeah, I think when we were writing that, we were very concerned with more even proprietary algorithms. So how do companies learn to sort something as simple as job applications? One company we found had been optimizing for location. And as a result, their hiring pool became extremely homogeneous because they were in a very white neighborhood. And so they didn't realize that even by optimizing for something as simple as short commutes was going to have this like really broad effect on the kinds of people that then got selected out. Right.
So Kathy O'Neill's been talking a lot about this.
Exactly. Yeah. And she's someone that we look to quite a bit for advising on that report. And as far as the Instagram thing, I really miss having a chronological feed because it's just, I'm going to out myself as sort of someone who enjoys surveillance, right? But you know where people are and you know what they're doing and you can say,
Instagram is made for stalking. Of course it is.
Yeah, but it's
benign
like
stalking.
I served someone's birthday party, from 3 days later and I look like, I wasn't paying any attention because I didn't see their post, but it's just that it didn't optimize for that. And as a result, I look like someone who's really behind the times when I comment.
The first thing you talked about is much more important in the long run, how we're letting big data unconsciously make decisions, often with improper or incorrect or just even not thought about algorithms. And that's certainly bad. But this it's related. It's the same. It's a sort of a religious faith in the algorithm that is not ill-founded. And it's I'm starting to think AI shouldn't stand for artificial intelligence. It should stand for algorithmic idiocy.
Well, we've had this for. Go ahead, Stacey.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say there's a great book out right now called Automating Inequality. And yeah, so just a play on the AI turn.
And that's what Kathy O'Neill, the math babe, talks about in her book, Weapons of Math Destruction, how big data increases inequality. Go ahead, Stacey.
We've been doing this for a while. We just haven't been doing it quite at the scale and without as much and across as many products or things that people touch in their day-to-day lives. We've been using data to cherry pick. We've been cherry picking data forever. But when we hand it over to computers, they're so much better at it and they don't have the same social inputs or mores or goals or aspirations even that we have that we don't think to program them with. So of course, I mean, this is going to happen. And I write about this a lot as it ties to like business transformation and industrial internet type things, because companies really have to think about what they're optimizing for. Because a lot of times if you optimize for revenue, you're going to either cut down on your workforce happiness, your product quality, and those are things that actually matter. And
yeah, it's actually dumb. It seems like it's the smart thing to do. BI, business intelligence, it's a smart thing to do. And Jeff Jarvis hates it when I use the term weaponized, but that's what we've done. We've weaponized it. We've always had it, but now we've got so much computation and so much data that we can use it in a deadly way.
Well, even in the advertising field, they talk about it as targets and waste, right? And it's just like weird ways to bucket people. But one of the things that we were...
Are you a target or are you waste?
Are you waste,
right? I wasted my ad spend on you, buddy boy.
Exactly, right? And, you know, conversion into action. But one of the things that we found really helpful in that... which is really just a very broad literature review, that piece. But we found those ProPublica studies of Facebook's advertising algorithm to be really, really helpful, because one of the things that ProPublica was able to show is how you can't just, you don't have to just target in, you can also target out different groups. And there's certain housing laws, certain non-discrimination places that people were using advertising that it was really clear that they were using racially biased or age biased advertising targeting. And so there's other ways of thinking about how the social media platforms do become weaponized in this sense. And I think it's really important that we, like, you know, treat them with the same expectations that we would someone placing an ad in a newspaper would, at that, you know, with that level of discernment and discretion.
Yeah, you're talking about the ProPublica study where they complained about Facebook doing this. Facebook said, we're not going to do it anymore. Then ProPublica went back and they still were being able to buy ads on Facebook that targeted whites.
Yeah, and they had changed like categories from, you know, to I think they're now called multicultural affinity categories. But if you actually look at your own, one thing that I always point out is I am categorized as African American according to Facebook's racial programming. And I think it has something to do with the kinds of friends that I have, the kinds of stories.
It's your likes. Your likes give you away. We saw that. Cambridge Analytica was basing its work on a study that showed that they can determine your gender, your race, your sexual orientation from, you know, give me 52 likes and I can tell you you're black, except you're not.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm not. I'm, you know,
I'm often a man, if it makes you feel better, Joan. I don't know.
Well, it's probably, you know, the kind of stuff that you study, right? You know, not a lot of women are in the business world in that capacity studying tech.
But we should really, I mean, I don't understand why companies don't, they think they're being smart, they're actually being dumb. And I think they think they're optimizing for engagement or sales or revenue. But when it has a consequence that in the long run doesn't improve any of that, they don't pay attention to it because they say, well, no, we have the algorithms. We have the computers. I'm telling you, I'm calling it algorithmic idiocy. That's going to be the name of my book.
Get on that, Leo.
Yeah, I know, right? Now you burned it, right?
Too late. I gave it away.
Yeah, it's a movement now.
It's a hashtag, not a title. It is. It's a hashtag, not a title. All right. We could start. We started off because I saw that and I thought that was a great thing. That Joan, before coming on, said, well, I tried to go through all 294 of Mary Meeker's slides, but I'm afraid I just can't do it. Every year, Mary Meeker does her Internet Trends report. She became quite famous for this, didn't she? This is
how she got her job at Kleiner.
Yeah.
Well, not solely this. She became famous originally in, you were around then, Leo, come on, 2000, predicting the top companies that were going to come out of the dot-com era.
She was an analyst at the time.
Yes, for Morgan Stanley?
Maybe. Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah. So now, of course, she now works for KP, but does the same slideshow, this time at the Code Conference, Internet Trends 2018.
I think it's always been at the Code Conference.
Has it?
I mean, not always.
Well,
but
it would have been Recode,
for as long as
and then
Recode
before
has
that,
been there,
D,
yeah.
All Things D. And 2017 was the first year in which smartphone unit shipments did not grow at all. Saturation.
That is what that is. But never fear, they're putting cellular subscriptions in your car, in your tracking collar,
my
possibly
oven.
Some baby thing. You know, we're going to be fine. The cellular carrier.
Same goes for internet user growth. Rose 7% in 2017. It was 12% the year before. That means it's slowing. But half the world is now online. That was the other interesting number. 49% of the world's population is now able to get online. I don't know what the standard for getting online is, but that was...
It depends. You know, the FCC for a long time had 512 kilobits per second. That was up until like 2010.
That's the broadband, yeah. Let's see what else. There's so many stats here. People are increasing the amount of time they spend online. U.S. adults spent 5.9 hours a day on digital media in 2017. That's up from 5.6. 3.3 of the almost 6 hours, more than half, on mobile.
Yes. Wow. And there was a lovely slide showing media consumption. I think it was like number 11 or 15, very early on. And that was eye-opening to me just because so much content is being watched on mobile compared to like TV and other things from just even a few years ago.
Yeah.
Daily hours spent. Slide 11. Hey, look at that.
Good. Good brains. Daily hours spent with digital media per adult user. And the
Why
green
are we
is mobile.
So much on our phones because it's there.
Instagram, Facebook.
Oh.
Right? Those are the sticky
ones.
I bet the big three are Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. I bet, but I don't know.
You can. There is an option on your phone to look at how long you look at apps. It's a built-in feature.
Both iPhone and Android has it, yeah.
Yeah, but it is telling because there is, we're watching now movies online. I know as a New York commuter, it's really easy to download something and listen to it or watch it on the metro rather than watch some of the other things that happen on the metro.
I think you're unusual, though. I mean, that's, I don't know. Is that a...
That's a very urban
I don't know if that's...
But...
So,
I think it's... If you're sitting there, I mean, I'm not proud of this, but sometimes I would just be so lazy and like maybe my Amazon integration with my television isn't working and I'll just be laying on the couch and I'm like, oh, screw it. I'll just watch it on my phone.
See, I never, ever watch movies on phone, tablet, or laptop, except if I'm not home.
Mm-hmm. Oh, now and then. And my daughter
actually.
Chat room,
how many of you at home, you don't, John, you're watching your TV. Carson says he'll watch on a tablet. You have kids. That might be why. Not Chromecast, Prawn, because that means you're watching it on the big screen. I don't mean controlling it with your phone. I mean actually looking on your small screen on your mobile. Aunt Pruitt says he does it all the time. So I don't know.
Aunt just gave me the best information in the chat room explaining that apparently today is National Donut Day. Is that true?
Donuts.
If it was, I missed it.
No, it is.
Are
not
you in
too
a different
late.
Time zone, Joan? It's not too late.
I know. Yeah, you're right. And I do live.
You live
yeah.
in the oh, city and, that and never sleeps, Joan. Yeah. Oh, it's
okay.
tomorrow.
And we're tomorrow. All okay, oh, you guys.
It's a week now.
You know how I find this stuff out? Do you know about this site? I should make this my tip of the week. Forecastwithak.com. This is a crowdsourced event calendar that does all the days, but it also
all
does
the days.
All the days. Like the National Spelling Bee final is today, or tomorrow, rather. Friday
oh,
is National.
Somebody from my daughter's school is going to be in it. I'm very excited for them. I get to root for a person. I'm very excited.
Prestidigitation. P-R-E-S. They're really hard. They give you really hard words that you do.
Oh, and cannot. Those kids, man.
They're
wow.
amazing. They've memorized them. So not only is Friday National Donut Day, but Kanye's album, solo album, comes out. So,
yeah.
And hurricane season starts.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is a great, I love this because there's a lot of geek stuff on it, but it's crowdsourced. So, you know, tomorrow SpaceX launch. It's also World No Tobacco Day. James Bond novel comes out in the UK, the new James Bond novel. See stuff, Expedition 56 launches on June 6th. I don't even know what that is. Ocean's 8 premieres on June 8th, World Oceans Day. So, yeah, National Donut Day is Friday. So, plenty of time, Joan.
Oh,
good to know.
It just keeps moving.
Yeah, yeah we've okay. decided to move it back for those of you who missed it.
Yeah, I could celebrate it today, tomorrow, and on Friday, actually.
You get a donut free at Dunkin' Donuts, by the way. So
I don't have Dunkin' Donuts. Plus, those are terrible donuts. No. Oh, yes. Yes, don't at me, people.
You just made an enemy out of the entire Northeast.
I don't get it myself. I grew up in the Northeast. I never had a Dunkin' Donut. They finally put a Dunkin' Donut in Petaluma, and I had my first Dunkin' just a couple of days ago. And they aren't good. They're not as good as Krispy Kreme.
Yeah, they're not as good as Krispy Kreme.
It's like if you ate them as a kid, though, it's a nostalgia thing.
Okay.
The flavors never change. They all have the same texture. It's just like, you remember them from a kid.
They're like those Italian cookies you get in the tin. They all taste exactly the same, but they just have different shapes. It's like that. What is it? The Stella Doro cookies? They all taste exactly the same.
Oh, those. Yes. They're just different. And they have the sugar crust on the top.
Yeah.
Sugar. Yeah.
But you would go, the thing is, you'd go with like your dad or something, you know,
yeah.
you get a coffee, yeah. you know, or they give you a munchkin or something.
It's a memory. Like, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I wouldn't tell you, you know, IHOP is the best breakfast, but there is a kind of nostalgia zone that you can hit, you know,
when
you're traveling. Oh, yeah. You know,
actually, new smartphone shipments. It's actually worse than she said on this slide. It looks like they've been tumbling for some time.
If you move into the enterprise, there's a couple noteworthy slides.
All right. Wi-Fi network. Wi-Fi adoption is rising. Look at that.
Yay. I can't believe that we had anywhere to go but up. But hey, But slide 201, way in there, we're talking about enterprising IT projects, which will see the largest spend increase in 2018. And this is from the beginning of the first quarter of this year to the beginning of the second quarter of this year. Networking equipment, which I thought was really interesting.
More even than artificial intelligence. I'm sorry.
That's
algorithmic
that
idiocy.
I was like, So I'm assuming that is... Wi-Fi, like it doesn't really describe what kind of networking equipment. Obviously, in the data center, you've got so much more network traffic that you've got to manage both east-west, so within the data center and across it. So I wonder if that's happening or if that's like Wi-Fi and Bluetooth and other like networks for enterprise networks. I'm not sure what that entails. So I'm very curious about that slide.
Yeah. What is hyper-converged infrastructure?
That is when you mush...
everything else.
Storage, networking, and compute all into one kind of thing. Cisco's had it. It's kind of like the answer that a lot of corporate companies offer for cloud. And by corporate, I mean like server vendors. It's
right.
kind of the last vestige of their profit margins.
Here's Moore's Law at work. $1,000 worth of computer equipment from it goes way back to the analytical engine in 1900. But we should probably start looking around 1975, which is about the middle of the chart. And but it is interestingly not exponential as one would expect with Moore's law. It's linear, but it's definitely a steep curve. How many calculations per second for $1,000 worth of computer equipment? And this is the other one, the storage price versus hard drive capacity. Wow. That's an even steeper downward curve.
Wow. My first computer had 256.
Yep. Megabytes. Megs, not gigs, kids.
Yeah, not gigs.
Not gigs.
I remember buying, like, was it a Pentium had 400 megahertz of processing power? Maybe? Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, because
The early Pentiums were 90 megahertz.
Okay, it was a slightly
later. You had a fast one, yeah.
My dad and I built a computer, and we built several.
Did you go to Dunkin' Donuts afterwards?
We did not. We went to Shipley's because we're in the South.
Oh, Shipley's.
Yeah. But I've since switched my donut loyalty to Krispy Kreme because they're lighter and fluffier, and Shipley's are a little heavy. I will eat them, though.
They're going to kill us. That's worse than not liking Chipotle.
There's not Jeff here to arbitrate, you know.
Yeah, we need Jeff for this.
He would defend one of those to the death. Yeah. I know he would.
There's so many slides. It's fun to look at, but it's kind of overwhelming.
Some other interesting slides I'll offer
you a little bit. You've already extracted the information.
So
you're so good.
Most it talks about consumer data sharing. So starting on 205, I was actually kind of surprised that almost 80% of us are willing to share our personal data for benefits.
Doesn't surprise me. No.
Okay. But then it talks, this I feel is Mary Meeker being a little bit in the Silicon Valley bubble, but she makes it sound like we're actually taking a lot of action to protect our data. I can see this kind of chart being used to self-regulate in a hard, like highly ineffective way. But talking about making consumer privacy tools more accessible, I don't agree with all of this, really.
She says 64% of the respondents to a Deloitte and Touche survey said they had deleted or avoided certain apps to protect privacy.
I think they're
privacy.
Just Deloitte now.
Luke. Oh, there's no Touche? Yep. They got rid of the Touche?
That went a while.
Really dating myself on that one. You know, back when the Edison light bulb company was in charge, things were better. 28% of disabled cookies, as if that does anything at all. 27% didn't visit or close certain websites. 26%, this is a complete lie from the respondents. 26% say, oh yeah, I closely read privacy agreements.
Oh my God, no way.
Liars.
I'm still reading my GDPR agreements, and I'm dying.
Liar! Liar! That's why you can't trust surveys for stuff like this. You really can't.
Well, here, you want a survey? This is going to get us off Mary Meeker for a minute, so I can bring us back, though, if we need to. How many people, or you guys, did you reboot your router?
Yes.
Because
I do it every day anyway, because it's...
there are those people.
So the FBI, we've been talking about this a lot. VPN filter is a malware created by Fancy Bear. You may remember them from the hack of the DNC some years ago. They are. They have infected, the FBI estimates, 500,000 consumer routers made by Linksys, Netgear, TP-Link, MikroTik with this VPN filter. And the FBI this week said everybody should reboot. Because now they had to wait. You couldn't reboot before because in rebooting would just reload the malware. But the FBI thinks that they stopped that because they shut down the photo bucket images that were... one way the malware was reloading, and they also shut down a website, toknowall.com. But Steve Gibson's looked a little deeper into the Cisco analysis of VPN filter. He said, even if you reboot your router is still beaconing to the malware servers. So this is the Talos, not Cisco, the Talos report. So he says the geeks amongst us would do best to rewrite their firmware. No, reset
Dude.
Won't do it.
That is hardcore.
A reset will not do it. You have to, well, it's not that hardcore because most routers, you know, you can download and update firmware. If you don't update it, actually update it if you can, but if you can't update it, just reinstall the existing firmware will overwrite the malware, that the little stub of the malware that loaded in all the other stuff. So even though, see, the FBI's advice was probably appropriate given the audience, because it certainly took those routers off the botnet, but they are still beaconing, and it's not clear that that means they've been, that they're no longer at risk. It might be that there's another method the Fancy Bear has figured out for getting the malware on the routers again. So best thing to do would be to get rid of all traces of VPN filter. And to do that, you need to overwrite your firmware.
Can I ask you a super technical question?
Sure.
Oh, okay.
No, go ahead, Stacey.
If you, so I run, I bridge my Eero routers and my cable to my cable modem, right? So my router is the Eero. My modem, though, also could act as a router. It just doesn't. So in my case, am I safe?
No. Your modem,
no,
your cable modem has a router in it.
Right.
So it doesn't, it's not the routing that's doing the bad stuff. It's merely using that router as a computer.
Got it.
That can be joined on the botnet. So even if you've disabled the routing features of that router, it could still be misused with VPN filter. So, and if you're not, even if you're not on the affected router list, you should, everybody should probably just reboot. It's harmless. It just takes you off the internet for, you know, a minute or two as you go back.
Harmless? Good Lord.
Harmless. Mostly
well,
harmless.
Most of us have our routers like shoved behind a cable box and underneath a kitchen table. It's like,
oh, that's a terrible place for your router. It can't be.
Well, I'm telling you right now, that's just, it, this is a New York apartment. It's very small.
It is what it is.
Yeah, it is what it is.
And it works.
Yeah, if I can get the Wi-Fi throughout the apartment, that's what matters. But I was going to say, when I lived in L.A., we would often, I was working at the Institute for Society and Genetics, and we had a few techie type people, and we would come up with screenplays, worst case dystopian scenarios about how we would, this was when Malcolm Nance's book came out, The Plot to Hack America, and we would often talk about what we would do. And I was like, the router attack. The movie would be called Status Update Terror, and take over all the routers, and then on a single day, it would like update everybody's social media status with some kind of horrible thing, like go outside, your job is canceled. I don't know, but yeah, this was the germ of my idea, which was that if you were really going to take over, the router is the most poorly understood piece of technical infrastructure that is also in everybody's home and necessary. And then when I moved to New York, I saw all of these Wi-Fi stations, these link systems, and I just thought, oh, it's bound to happen, you know, because it's like the public infrastructure Wi-Fi just seems to be, such a easy space to think about, like, if you were going to do something crazy.
Well, Stacey's basically become an expert on this as an IoT expert. I mean, this is, the router is one of many IoT devices. Any device that's on the internet is, you know, I mean,
I don't,
you probably
consider the router an IoT device.
I know.
Is why I get so upset with these.
You talk about, it's not. But for the purposes of this discussion, any device in your house that's on the internet is an IoT device.
Routers are particularly problematic because they have access to all the bandwidth and usually have strong enough computers that they can actually do something.
Right. You're not going to put VPN filter on a Hue light bulb.
Hope not. Well, they are powered.
They're powered, and they have some firmware and some processor. It just depends what you need. And, you know, most of the time, these botnets don't need a lot of processing power. The speculation from Talos is that Fancy Bear was creating this massive botnet, and 500,000 soldiers in your botnet's a pretty damn big botnet.
If they were light bulbs, though, they would do nothing because they'd be limited by Zigbee. They would have no bandwidth.
Oh, well, did you see that there is a Z-Wave hack?
We will talk about that in a bit.
Steve says it's not as bad as it sounds.
It's not as bad as it sounds.
Good.
I'm going to echo Steve. I'm going to echo Steve.
But to echo the book you were talking about, Status Update Terror.
It's a screenplay. We'll see if it ever gets made. Netflix, call me.
If not Netflix, funny or die. It's going to be one of the two.
Yeah. It's just even listening to you explain to people, you know, oh, this is how you might update it. But the notion that you would actually have to get to the firmware and do something significant, the router is such an important thing, but there's no... there's no helpline, really. There's no.
So this is why I actually, Stacy, you said this, and I give you credit because this is actually the right thing. And this is why I lump routers in with IoT devices. Do not buy any device in your house that goes on the internet that is not being kept up to date by its manufacturer and does not have pushed firmware updates. Because to your point, Joe, no one should have to go around and figure out if there's an update for your oven, doorbell, light bulbs, cameras, or routers. They should just be updated. Unfortunately, there are not a lot of routers that do this. All the mesh routers do, fortunately. But and they're, I'm sure.
For now. Bum, bum,
well,
bum.
Right, because how long are they, when does the life cycle end?
Well, that is a good question. Although, I mean, I replace my routers probably every 5 years.
Oh,
at
yeah,
least.
You should for sure, yeah.
Probably three, but.
Because they get burnt out. So the Talos says that what Fancy Bear was up to with this botnet was a Ukraine attack and probably to bring down the grid again. They've already, the Russians brought down the, it's believed, brought down the Ukrainian grid for several hours last year. And it's not that they don't particularly like the Ukrainians. They're a very good test bed for what they want to do to the West when the time comes. So this is all cyber warfare.
I don't think they do like Ukraine.
Well, they don't like the Ukrainians either. But
I was like, wait, I think they're actually
they're their favorite whipping boys. That's a long tale for another day. This is cyber warfare. That's why the FBI rightly should be involved. This is not a hack to get into your a system so they can get your credit card numbers. This is not a hack to some kid wants to take down a Twitch streamer. This is cyber warfare. This is aimed directly, ultimately, at the West and probably at the grid. Although there are other things that could use it against as well.
You guys will probably know the answer to this. Did we ever get to the bottom of why there was a internet blackout a few years ago? Like, I remember seeing that IoT was somehow involved.
Yes,
but
that was the Mirai botnet. That was the Mirai botnet. Same exact thing, except this time it was two kids from, where were they? Duke? Rutgers. It wasn't Fancy Bear. It was Fancy Pants. But otherwise, exactly the same. It was Mirai infected routers.
They attacked Netflix and
DYN was the one that.
DYN is who they. That's
because
right.
that was a big DNS server for a lot of companies, and it had the effect of taking a bunch of them down, including Netflix. But the irony of that, and this is how this is quantifiably different. Certainly qualitatively different, and actually, yes, quantifiably different, is that was two college kids who were trying to make a DDoS network for taking down, I think it was Twitch accounts, that they could sell. You know, here you could take your favorite streamer offline. But it got out of control. That's what that was. This is a nation state harnessing a massive army in order to, target another nation state. That's This is serious stuff. Minecraft servers. You're right. Thank you. The geek reminds me in the chat room. It was Minecraft servers that these Rutgers kids were trying to bring down with Mirai.
Well, if it makes money, I mean, why not try? I think the thing that scares me the most about hearing about, botnets like this, as well as the big talk last year about fake accounts online and impersonation and sock puppets, and then the sort of wars around automated amplification through bots, is that we have to start to think about these as multi-frontal attacks, right? The idea isn't that they're, really focusing on one specific sector of the internet, but they're thinking across the spectrum of platforms, software, hardware, which is definitely something much harder to take control of, but also could be much more effective in causing a really big blackout or, putting people up for, putting State Department resources up for ransom. I mean, so much of the internet has left us vulnerable to these open-ended attacks, that I think that you're right to say that this is different than people messing around. But when I hear about it, I think about all of these other ways in which we are insecure in our information ecosphere, as well as insecure in our, you know, networks. And I wonder, I wonder how these things are eventually going to fit together.
Well, this is right up your, this is your, what you do. This is the stuff you research. But I actually have been wanting to ask you this, because what's become more and more clear, I think initially the kind of the simplistic interpretation of it was, the Russians wanted, did not want Hillary Clinton to win the election. They want, so they, it wasn't so much they wanted Donald Trump. They just didn't want Hillary Clinton because they didn't like her. And so they did some stuff to, you know, bought ads on Facebook and created fake accounts and in order to swing the election. That turns out to have been not a very simplistic view of what was going on. And it's, I think, very clear now. It's a highly coordinated attack. It's an intent is to coordinate, to attack the West in not just fake news, but with routers and with everything else to disrupt the West. Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with disrupting the election. That was just a part of an overall thing. So it's not just the memes. It's not just Pepe the Frog. It's everything.
Yeah. Yeah, and we've been thinking about this in the office a lot, because we're trying to understand the effect that this has had large scale across multiple institutions, right? We're looking at now reports of, military style attacks on information in the sense that there are, battles that never happened, shots that never took place that are getting reported. We're seeing climate reports that were untrue, right? But they're getting reported as real events, fake storms or fake chemical spills. And we're trying to understand what is a test and what is a scenario that they're trying to run, and then how would they scale those scenarios? And for me, I think, when people start messing with democracy or the press, those are very open systems. They're open social institutions.
And they're very vulnerable as a result.
They're very vulnerable. But then we have to think about how might the techniques learned there scale to law, economy, and so we have to be really careful as we move forward with our policies about infrastructure and how we're going to moderate the internet, because I've already hearing people talk about, splinter nets, and people are thinking about, maybe it's the right time for one internet over here to lock up the internet borders. And part of me wonders if, what the damage we're going to do holistically to what makes the net great by trying to lock down all of these different problems. But I think the economy right now is very, very vulnerable to attack, especially because so much information that flows through platforms is about when and what to purchase related to stock. And there have been attempts to manipulate the information about stocks to get people to either buy or sell. That's as old as the stock market itself. But I'm wondering about how might that scale and how.
Well, that's an interesting vector, isn't it?
It is, but it's a hard, hard system.
You attack the grid, you attack the economy, the markets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You attack the press. Mm-hmm. So I guess really the larger question is, well, what does Putin want?
Yeah. And I don't know if it's only him that is at the forefront of some of this, right? There's just, there's so much of this that we study is just in the name of chaos itself. And so there's a lot of fellow travelers.
I think that certainly a lot of the players, especially the American players, are, in it for the lulls.
Yeah.
But puppet master, there's a goal. Putin wins maybe if there's chaos in the West, but I think that there's got to be a larger goal. I mean, he does clearly the West is a threat to him. The European Economic Zone was a massive threat to Russia. Mm-hmm. A strong U.S. and its sanctions are a threat to Russia.
And oil and gas is still an important industry there, and there was all those problems with Tillerson, which was supposed to be he's supposed to be a peacemaker. And so I think that Putin maybe anticipated having stronger ties and better connections with the government that's in place. But also, I mean, you can only set up and stage and strategize so much, but it's hard to predict what people in power want when they're multi-billionaires as well, because they have everything that they could possibly want.
Wow, but you also don't want a destabilized West, because that's your market. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's one of the reasons I don't worry about China so much. Go ahead, Stacey.
No, I was just going to say Putin, and there is a certain might makes right kind of category in the concept of a liberal democracy where you look out for people. I know we're not quite living it, but the idea of, you know, looking out for people and not letting strongmen take over, that is very threatening to both his worldview, but also the way his country is currently run.
Right.
So it makes a lot of sense that getting us to a point of chaos where authoritarianism looks good, I mean, that would be awesome. It would be a win for his worldview.
If you Google what does Putin want, you'll find about 8,000 different points of view. And I don't know. It's certainly not we're not experts in this, and it's not our
That's
bailiwick.
Not going to be scientific.
But what is interesting to us is I think it's become very clear now that a lot of there's starting to take shape. That, I mean, and I think this botnet, this VPN filter, is just the latest piece in the puzzle. It's starting to take shape that there's a concerted effort in a lot of different spheres. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the things that we are talking about all the time on this show, fake news, viruses, mm-hmm. security, privacy. I hate to have a scapegoat, right? I hate to mm-hmm. say, it's the Ruskies. We did that for a whole generation. Oh, it's the Soviet Union. But
yeah,
maybe there is. Maybe it is.
No, I think a lot of us are abdicating our responsibility to look out for each other and to take as much responsibility as we can for our situations and those of our neighbors and our friends and our citizens. So
yes, I agree 100%. It's too easy to blame Putin.
I think that he taps into a certain level of lulzy chaos that he does exploit for gain. In terms of like the kind of media that they run, the state-run media, it's definitely, you know, preferable to have a narrative about America being in chaos and being able to show that and have that also reflected in the media in America that says we don't know how to fix our systems. Right. And it's like, you know, and as you start to look across all these important sectors of institutions, you start to see, you know, many, many more, instances of polarization. And so this demonstrates, I think, to someone who's a very authoritative ruler is that, you know, if you can handle, you can keep a hold on your country's narrative, other countries look, very like, you know, that the state is going to fail in a big way because they've chosen this economic route, these, you know, cultural values. And so there's much to be won in terms of like creating a narrative of propaganda for your state.
It's fascinating.
I don't know if we want to keep talking about Russia.
No, we went down a rabbit hole on that one. But
I will say California, their Senate just passed 23-12, a net neutrality bill. I don't know if you guys care about that.
I live in California, so I do.
There you go. A lot of your people might.
Although California, by the nature of the size of its economy, does definitely influence the nation as a whole, right?
Yes. So now it will go to your state assembly and it will be voted on hopefully in early fall.
Can a state restore net neutrality?
It can restore aspects of it in that state.
Using
among
its
buyers.
Economic.
Yeah. Clout. People who buy it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So
well, I'm
I
glad
don't know.
That passed. I mean, so
it'll be interesting if it does pass. It'll be interesting to see, like, if your state decides. I mean, are you really going to get AT&T to? I don't know. We'll see what happens.
Here's the good news: AT&T and Comcast and two major industry trade groups spent $1 million lobbying Sacramento, and it failed. So there's that.
I don't, wait, hold on. Only $1 million?
I know, that seems so low. Guys, come on.
Let me see what Uber spent in Austin when they were trying to get us to not kick them out.
Oh, a lot more than $1 million. Yeah.
I think it was like $10 million spent.
Anyway, but you're right. It does have to, it's got to get through both houses. It passed the Senate.
Yeah. It topped $10
million. Yeah. Comcast.
Okay.
Comcast, you're letting us down here. So the Senate has passed it. That's very good news. I don't know what the prospects are in the assembly, but if you're in California, call your state assembly member and say, pass SB 822. SB 822, that's good. We like it.
It won't be SB 822 when it gets to
be whatever
the assembly,
it is,
right?
AB. Yeah.
Sorry.
They'll know. If you say SB 822, they'll know which one you mean. Actually, you probably
shut
say
up, Stacey.
That net neutrality law. You know, that thing.
There you go.
That rule. You want to actually let's take a break because I think I need some coffee. Do you need some coffee, Stacey? Do you drink coffee?
Not anymore.
I
I'm trying so hard. It's so hard. I would love to drink coffee.
You think that it might be related to
the migraines?
I thought caffeine is
the
used.
The first thing coming back.
Oh, that's good. I thought caffeine was sometimes used to treat migraines.
It is, but apparently regular caffeine use for certain kinds of people with certain kinds of migraines, it can be a trigger. It also becomes less effective if you're automatically, if you're...
Save it for when you need it.
Yes.
I need it every day. Sometimes several times a day. And fortunately, we have found the best coffee. Our official coffee of Twit comes from a single family farm in Brazil, Três Pontas. Now, I know in Portuguese it would be Três Pontas, but I'm saying Três Pontas because I want you to be able to spell it because I want you to go to Três Pontas, TRESPONTAS.com/twig, and get some of this amazing premium coffee, non-GMO. It's a single family farm. They've never sold in the U.S. before, but the Race family thought, hey, you know, let's try this. So they arranged to have their coffee shipped, green beans shipped to the U.S., fresh roasted in the U.S. for quick shipping to you. These beans we got 5 days after they were roasted. They were roasted on May 21st, so they're still very fresh. Let me open them. Actually, before I open the bag, I want to show you the coolest thing. On every bag of Três Pontas, and this is the this is from the Minas Gerais farm in Brazil. This is a French roast. It's the smoothest cup of coffee you ever had. Actually, there's a reason for that. Coffee grown on the Race family farm. So it's pulped natural, not washed. That means the pulp is still on it. That makes a smoother cup. Most other coffees, equatorially grown coffees, they have to wash them because of mold problems. They don't have that problem at the high mountains in Brazil. See, here is pulped natural. Now watch this. This is so fun. There it is. I have to do it again now so you can see it. So I take a picture of the QR code on the bag. And then look, here's the Google Maps. You can actually see the bush where the bean. There it is. Here's where the bean was grown. Right there. That's the Race family farm on the hillside there on Três Pontas. Let me open this up, though. You got to smell this. I'm sorry, Stacey and Joan, you can't. And no, I guess no one can except me. It's so good. It's the best coffee you ever had. So smooth. Now, here's the deal. We're going to get you a special offer. If you go right now and subscribe at tracepontes.com/twig. All right, you got to see these beans. Oh. Drove Andy and Akko crazy yesterday because he wanted to smell them. Look at those beans. They're fresh, pulp natural, just delicious. So good you just might want to eat them right out of the bag. Here's the deal. If you go to tracepontes.com/twig, you're going to get 10% off your subscription. You can have them every 1, 2, or 4 weeks. 12 ounces of beans. I like the idea of a smaller bag mailed on a more regular basis because then it's always fresh. You can choose from light, medium, dark, and French roast. This is the French roast. Shipping is free in the U.S. When you subscribe, you get 10% off. But if you do it at tracepontes.com/twig, another 10% off when you use the offer code TWIG for a total of 20% off your subscription every month. 20% off. This would be an awesome Father's Day gift. You could tell Dad the whole story about the farm. Say, Dad, take the picture of the QR code. TresPuntas.com/twig. Use the offer code TWIG for 20% off every bag of coffee in your subscription. You can also order on Amazon if you just wanted to, you know, do it easily, but you don't get this, you don't get the 20% off. Gotta go to TresPuntas.com/twig. All right, Stacey, you can uncover your ears. We're done talking about coffee.
Oh, but are you still drinking it? Because just watching someone drink it, I'm like, oh man.
Oh man. Yeah, I don't know if I could I could give up the brew.
It's honestly not that I've ever kicked a drug habit or anything super hard, but it is one of the harder things I've ever done.
See, if I don't drink coffee, I get a headache.
Well, yeah, and I did a slow taper. So,
yeah.
And believe me, I end up going back on the caffeine. Now I'm back on the, I'm coming off the wagon, back on the, I don't know which wagon I'm on.
It's hard. You're on and off the wagon all the time.
It's terrible.
Chrome 67 is out. I want to show you something kind of cool with a new Chrome. There are apparently a number of new features, but first of all, this is what you need to do is go to settings and under settings about Chrome, and you see I'm on 66, so it's going to download and does it pretty quickly, 67. I think it eventually just does it automatically, right? Updates Chrome automatically.
I don't think I've ever manually updated Chrome yet.
You might want to on this one. If you're interested in, among other things, and I know you are, progressive web apps. So there's...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm going to... It's downloaded. I'll relaunch. And then the first thing you do after you relaunch is Chrome:/flags. So these are the kind of experimental settings in Chrome. Let me make this a little bit bigger so you can read.
Oh, I was like, wow, what's happening?
It's tiny. Experiments. Type in PWA in the search, and you're going to enable all three of these. Enable full code cache. PWA is this progressive web app that gives you the capability of going to a site. We'll go to mobile Twitter. There are a lot of progressive web apps. And install it basically as a Chrome app.
Cool.
And you're going to be able to do this also on iOS and Android. So, okay, I've done that. I'm going to relaunch one more time. And go back to Chrome flags, and I'm going to type app. Here it is. What was it? It was app. Banners. Here we go. Enable the display of progressive web app banners. And experimental. Yeah, let's do those. We're going to turn those on. This for now, is an experimental feature. It's the progressive web apps. But let's go to, all right, Trivago. We'll do this one, trivago.in. So this is, if I go to trivago.in, it looks like a website. But if I go to settings, you'll see
This makes me feel a lot better, Leo, because this is me installing every IoT device.
I know.
Like, this happens, and oh, wait, it didn't happen.
I know. I did this on the... Windows Weekly minutes ago, you know, partly because I'm on, I have Edge as the default browser here, which is probably part of the problem. Let's try it with m.twitter. .com. That's the Twitter progressive web app. Go to the menu. Yeah, open in Twitter Lite. So I guess you know what? I know why. Because I did it on the other computer. It was already installed. What you will see is install Twitter Lite. This is a PWA. Now, this is going to show up in your folder, your Chrome Apps folder, as a progressive web app. So this is the new hotness, the idea that websites, it looks like a website, but in fact, it's code that you can download and make kind of semi-permanent. Here's another one. Let's try the, I guess the Trivago. It's only because I have it open. Whoops. Trivago.in. And again, I'm going to open it in Trivago. This is a standalone PWA, Progressive Web App. So if you want to play with those, Chrome still has to launch, kind of like the Chrome apps, but it's a different model entirely. And it is now enabled in 67. And I'm sure there's other great reasons to get 67.
Doesn't it have the automatic stopping of, or automatic yes. muting of, that was my big excitement.
Yeah,
right?
Of noisy tabs.
Mm-hmm. I was like, that's worth it, you know, no matter what you feel about web apps.
Yes. Yes, go for the noisy tabs, but stay for the web apps. That's my motto.
That's the glitz that'll get you in the door.
Get you in the door. All right, now hold on. That process, I've closed my rundown, so let me go back to that. There was a lot more in the Mary Meeker slideshow about internet advertising, but we don't need to cover that. We don't really care.
That's only Google's core business.
Oh, actually, there are some interesting slides in there I could show you.
I'm like, let me go back and pick up some Google. I feel like we haven't talked about Google very much. And, you know,
let me finish the Chrome thing. Let me finish this because I forgot to mention this. There is also a generic sensor. Now, this may be a bad thing. A generic sensors API. It exposes data from device sensors to public websites. So your accelerometer, your gyroscope, your orientation, your motion sensors can now be read by apps.
Wait, the ones in our sensors or in our phones can be read by how?
Using this API. Not in your iPhone, probably. I bet you. But if you're using Chrome on your phone,
okay.
Then, for instance, you could have, if you use a VR headset like the Google Gear, the Daydream mm-hmm. or the Samsung Gear, the phone sensors now can be read by the app that's running in Chrome to monitor head movement, things like that.
I was thinking you were talking about all of the sensors that I have around my house with accelerometers.
No, not those. Just your phone.
How does that happen?
How good at it? Can't read those. A lot more security, strict site isolation. That's, I think, what you were talking about. That actually will help with Meltdown and Spectre. Passwordless authentication via WebAuthn. They've dropped support for public key pinning. And then the support for PWAs is in there. So there's a lot of new stuff. And this is a big update to Chrome 67. Just came out. You want to see the new Chrome UI? We can do that too. Let me go to Chrome. /flags. Do this one more time. Search for UI. UI layout for the browser's top Chrome. Is that the one? I don't know. Let me go back to this page. Let's see what the flag is. UI layout for the browser's top Chrome. UI layout for the browser's top Chrome. And what do I choose? You want the refresh design. Okay. Refresh. You ready? Should we check? Let's see what the new layout looks like.
Don't do it.
Looks exactly the same.
Oh.
All right.
Thank goodness for
so
that.
So much for that. Toggles between normal for clamshell devices, hybrid, previously touch, for devices with a touch screen. That's probably what I should put on here. Touchable. New user unified interface for touch and convertibles, and material design refresh. That's the new one. It's now more. It is a little more material. It's a little prettier. Well, I'm glad I wasted 5 minutes doing that.
It's okay.
It's Google. All right. Should we go back to the Meeker slides?
You want to know what men who aren't in jobs spend most of their time doing?
I do. What do men who aren't working spend most of their time doing?
It appears, more of them, I guess, spend 3 more hours. Is this a week? Daily watching television.
Yes, I agree.
But only an additional 0.6 hours sleeping. That's other, including sleep. So I'm kind of like, dang. And even less doing household activities and services. So
that we knew too. Here's another slide for something that you knew. Locomotive jobs versus aircraft jobs. Why is this in here?
That is showing that technological change doesn't kill jobs. It brings them in new places. So the next couple slides discuss farm work.
Agricultural versus service. So the point being the rise in service jobs more than made up for the loss of agricultural jobs.
And maybe I'm just becoming more cynical with old age, but looking at these slides, I'm actually kind of stunned at how it glosses over a lot of the inequalities of things like the Airbnb housing, like how it increases rents in cities, how it glosses over things like the flexibility offered by the gig economy, but you know how that's not necessarily offset by having a job that you can depend on. So I'm getting kind of frustrated as I look through this. I'm like, hey, your worldview that is looking cracked and kind of not egalitarian is showing, I guess.
Yes, but that's technologists, right? And I would guess that the kind of reason that she doesn't spend time on it is the underlying assumption, almost, you know, just a given that, well, it all works out in the end. That's the point, right? So yeah, there's dislocations here, but then there's improvements here and it all is going to work out. For instance, you talk about gig economy. Has technology made it easier to find freelance work? 77% say yes.
So I look at this. On-demand jobs filling needs for workers who want extra income, flexibility, et cetera. Right. And there's a whole section on Etsy and Airbnb and Uber. But I think you are right
that there is among technologists this just kind of basic assumption that, well, you're going to have disruption, but it's all going to work out in the end.
I guess.
Sometimes it feels tone deaf
right now.
Yeah, it does. Sometimes with a mystery variable, like we're going to throw in, basic income. There, that'll fix it. That'll make the equations balance.
Have either of you been following any of the storyline around the taxi medallions in New York and the rise of Uber, Lyft, and other ride-sharing apps at all?
So yes, but I am so skeptical of that as a quote-unquote storyline. I understand the narrative. I understand how these things play into it. I really have a lot of questions about, is it just Uber or is it the lack overall of a safety net?
In a thumbnail, what is the story?
Well, it's been on the news a lot. There's been 5 cab driver suicides related to having purchased these medallions with they were over $1 million in some cases just a few years ago. But that the city knew, or they're speculating that the city knew that these ride sharing apps were coming and there wasn't anything done to ease the market. And there's all these laws and regulations about the standardization of the cabbie schedules and the standardization of how much it costs. So everybody gets the same rate, right? And that's supposed to be a virtue in this economy, is that you don't get into the cab and they can just name their price. But as a result, a lot of people are feeling both that they were scammed, but also that there's really no way out of this debt. I've been seeing videos.
So is the medallion price set, market set completely?
They're generally auctioned, but many of them went on the market, you know, decades ago, and people bought them and they get passed down through families or they get sold.
But somebody must have some point done a calculation saying, well, it's going to cost $1 million, but I will pay it off in X number of years, right? Or it wouldn't make sense to buy it. You know, in other words, the taxi is going to earn this much to make it up. So what you're saying is that, it feels to me like, well, I'm sorry that these guys got screwed, but $1 million for a medallion is a lot.
Yeah, it used to be worth it.
And you would buy it like you'd pay down a mortgage. It would be a 30-year span. And the belief was that the city would enforce such regulations so that the ride-sharing apps couldn't take over such a high proportion of the market. Similarly, in London, There were, you know, it's very, very expensive to get a cabbie license in London. You have to memorize 600 points of interest. And
by allowing ride sharing, you live in New York, right, Joan?
Yep.
So have you noticed, so I've heard all sorts of anecdotal stuff. Like, well, the reason the traffic is so bad in Manhattan is because you've got, you know, half of the traffic is Ubers and Lyfts. Mm-hmm. Somebody in the chat room is saying that this is Hell's Kitchen, NYC. So I take it he lives in the city. Taxi medallions in New York were awarded during the Depression to stop exactly what these ride-sharing people are doing. My street near the theater district, just a bunch of Uber X cars sitting double parked waiting for a call, which they never get. I go and I easily get a cab. He says the medallion system may be broken, but it was better than what's going on right now. So maybe the upset is that that the city should never have allowed, as Austin tried to, never allowed ride sharing.
Well, we allowed ride sharing. We just didn't allow those who didn't have background checks. We were not against ride sharing.
There are many cities, though, who just don't want ride sharing.
Mm-hmm. There was a definite problem, not necessarily in New York so much as like in San Francisco. You know, you can never get a cab in San Francisco prior to Uber launching.
That's why Uber is such, Uber is beloved. Same thing with LA. So, it's beloved because it's the only way you can get a ride.
And there are definitely people it helps. I mean, I look at my mother-in-law who can't really drive anymore, but has the income to pay for people.
Right.
And, you know, other than calling a cab every time she wants to go someplace and hoping it shows up.
Right.
Now she just
opens
an app.
My mom stopped, you know, got rid of her car a few years ago. She's 86, which was a good thing safety-wise for her and everybody on the road. And she took cabs, but she never liked taking cabs. She was always afraid of the cabbie. But I had to persuade her, so she would wait till my sister could drive her, which often was inconvenient for my sister and not great for mom either. I set up Uber and Lyft on her phone, and I had set it up with my credit card. And I said, "Now, mom, you know, just do this." And she was very nervous about using that, very, because she'd heard all the bad stories about Uber drivers and so forth. But once she started using it, and she pretty much gets, you know, the same two or three guys every time, she loves it now. It's for her, it's real freedom.
Right.
Of course, I'm paying for it.
Well,
but I
prefer, you're a good son.
Well, it's frankly, I would do the same for my kids. I would much prefer they take Uber because it's more expensive to have a car in many cases, right?
Well, I think in New York, a lot of people rely on it because, it's crazy to try to have a car and do all the parking. But there is a level of congestion, and then there's just the there's certain basic rules about surge pricing and things that I think do need to get dealt with so that there's some predictability as well. One of the things that I've been noticing in the discourse from the cabbies is that there's no ADA access with Uber. So anytime anybody with some kind of mobility or disability issue that would need a wheelchair lift and things, they aren't able to call and have access to those services equally. And I think that when we see broad changes to regulation, it's going to have to take account of some of these discrepancies.
And the other issue, of course, with medallions is there's a lot of corruption, isn't there? I mean, wasn't the Taxi King just indicted?
Yeah, no, that, I mean, it's very hard for me to conjure sympathy for an industry that has generally, it's like anything. You have, you know, the garbage men, if they decide that they're not going to pick up your garbage, there's not a lot of options, right? And if the taxi lobby had decided, that people, you know, like, for instance, the idea that they wouldn't come pick you up. I mean, I've been through this many times when I was living in LA. If you were to call a taxi service and it was, you know, you're going to the airport at 4 o'clock in the morning, you were really rolling the dice. But the apps, like, they provide other services that are useful, like the tracking and the mapping and the cancellation and things that you don't get from just making a phone call and crossing your fingers.
Yeah. Here's a slide that I can't wait to see next year's version of it, the post-GDPR version. This is the internet advertising ad spend, up 21% year over year. And look at the gray bar is mobile. Look at how mobile is growing. But I bet you next year, we're already hearing that programmatic ad sales in Europe have plummeted after GDPR. It's only been a week.
That makes sense. But something, so there's a really interesting macro thing to think about. We are talking about, oh my God, you can't get the LA Times or USA Today in Europe without going through a VPN. Okay. But this is what we're trying to do. We're trying to regain our privacy on the internet. The challenge is, there will be disruption. Will we come through on the other side with a sustainable business model that doesn't traffic in our data? And it could be a hugely positive thing. And maybe I'm naive, and yes, I am sort of, but I am optimistic. We could take this as an opportunity to say, hey, engagement doesn't matter because we don't want all these people. We're less of an ad-generated model, and maybe we go more towards a value model on some platforms, and then people will pay for things. Yes, it does mean we have to pay for things.
But for some reason, I hear Jeff's voice in my head at this point.
I know. And I'm not going to say, you know, this is an opportunity to rethink some of the things, the assumptions that we've let big companies build the web on. And right. I don't think we've all realized that. And as we realize that, this is a good chance to see it laid bare. And I think we're going to start in a few, hopefully weeks, seeing stories that talk about what data is actually out there. And I honestly can't wait. So we need to have this reckoning, I guess.
Yeah, I think this is always coming. Well, maybe I don't know if it's always coming, but I think it is. It's been a long time coming, let's put it that way. And I'm glad it's here.
And because we've gotten so far without it, I think we're actually going to go further in the realm of sharing our data than we might have otherwise done. So.
Right. Well, that's one of the things Meeker says, that tech companies are in a privacy paradox. They're caught between using data to provide better consumer experiences, like Google, and violating consumer privacy. And different companies choose different points on that balance. Obviously, Apple's, tilted toward privacy. Google's tilted towards better, quote, better consumer experiences. Mm-hmm. We talk about that a lot.
It's interesting to me, too, though, when I was talking to some students about data and privacy and asking about, how they get, how they end up seeing the ads that they wanted to see. And the notion of they didn't really have a notion of what they didn't see. Right. And so I often wonder about if advertising was less personalized, would it open up a different set of options for people? I know for me, the kind of advertising that I hate is, when I make a one-time purchase, right? When I moved to New York, we had to buy a bed, and for months I was getting Target marketed mattress ads.
And that's because they knew you moved?
I had searched for mattresses.
Oh, you searched for it. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. I did it to myself, but at the same time.
Well, you did it.
I think what's more interesting, I don't know if you guys saw the Ars Technica story. It was based on it was about personal injury lawyers targeting ads to people in emergency rooms.
Okay.
So this came That's out creepy. Yesterday. It was based on reporting from the Philadelphia WHYY affiliate. And basically what happened is marketers were taking data from phone data.
So location data, yeah.
It wasn't always location data. So they were using geofencing, but they were using either your Wi-Fi data. So like Euclid is a company that keeps data on phones and their Wi-Fi networks and where they are, that sort of thing. GPS data and or cellular data. So your cellular carrier might give this to them.
Yeah.
And then they were saying, hey, when you're in the ER and for a while afterwards, you would get ads personally. What's even more wild is was it Connecticut? I think I don't know if it was in here or in the original story, they were, one of the state attorneys generals had come down on this practice for anti-abortion groups targeting ads towards people who were waiting in Planned Parenthood and other reproductive health organizations. So if you were in one of those places, you would start getting like those ads that are like, a fetus is a baby, kind of those kind of things. And they were like, yeah, that's not cool, you guys. But that's where, like, I think we're headed if we're not careful.
How much harm, though, is there really in getting, I mean, you're going to get ads on your phone when you're in that emergency room. It's not like you're going to get more ads. You're going to get ads one way or the other. So maybe you're going to get ads for something. I understand, but.
It's like when Target was like, hey, that chick is pregnant before anyone realized it. That's the creepy line. And when you cross it, you know, people are
in that case, that's you know, that maybe that pregnancy could be revealed to somebody before the person who was pregnant was willing to reveal it or whatever. But so you get ads that are targeted at your geolocation.
What if you're in the
emergency? Why is that creepy?
What's creepy is because these people know where you are. Some weird stranger.
No one knows where you are. That's the perception, but it's not the reality. The reality is the lawyers bought ads from Facebook or whatever. Said, well, it's when anybody's there, please show them that ad. They don't have your information.
Right. The middleman is Google. Google has all that information.
Or Facebook, either way. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, whoever your middleman broker is.
Right.
But the perception, it's people wake up to the fact that they are literally carrying something around in their pocket that can be used to track them in all kinds of ways.
But if we explain to them, well, it's not that the lawyer knows where you are. The lawyer barred ads based on people's location. Facebook and Google know where you are. Did you know that Facebook knows where you are? Well, yeah, I knew that. Did you know that Google knows where you are? Maybe they didn't know that. So now they know.
So what happens when the cops start subpoenaing that data from companies? What if that digital ad broker
that Securus was selling geolocation information from phones to law enforcement?
And what if this company is terrible at practicing good IT hygiene and security, and they get breached? So then someone else does know.
They should.
But that's the point. You don't have control over it. They realize that they've got these things. They don't understand the network of information, and they don't understand how it can be abused or not abused.
They're upset.
And they should be upset.
Should they be upset?
Yes. Look at like things like Equifax, whichever one.
Equifax.
You've got massive collections of individual data that are, they're like icebergs. You don't know what all's underneath the surface, and you don't know who has access to it, and you will never see it. That's one of the exciting things about GDPR is it tries to make that visible to the end user or the consumer, the person whose data it is. And I think that's really important.
Well, I do. In principle, I love that idea. But if the impact of it is it undermines something that isn't in fact creepy, it's just selling ads based on your location.
How do we know it's creepy? We started off the show talking about algorithmic bias. This data can be used in all kinds of different ways, and sense of that.
Yeah, and I agree. And we should limit how it's used, and we should have strong protections about where it goes and so forth.
We can't limit how it's used if we don't understand who's using it. We need to have transparency over what data is shared to whom, and then how that middleman puts things together. Maybe it's okay that only Google has this information because they already had it anyway and that lawyers don't know, but people need to understand that.
Yeah, I think people should be fully informed. I don't disagree with that. In fact, I think if they are fully informed, they won't find it as creepy. And then I think there should be strong laws against, as there are in GDPR, data breaches need to be revealed. Companies have a higher burden of protecting your private data and all of that. But I don't think that the actual transaction itself of buying an ad based on location is inherently creepy.
I don't know. What if you, I think the abortion provider ads are pretty, especially because it's such a vulnerable time in someone's life. And again, in the ER, it's a vulnerable time. Yeah. It's ambulance
problematic
chasing.
Because
it's virtual ambulance chasing. Hate that.
So do you want to block all geofencing? Because you could also be, I see you're at Orchard Supply. Let me give you some coupons. Do we want to block that?
All of that.
So you want to block all of that?
I want the choice to block. I want the choice to block all of that. I really do. I hate how Google is constantly like, I see you're at this place. We need some help. Oh, mm-hmm. Would you provide us a photo? Or even if you want to offer me a 20-cent discount on a cup of coffee because I'm outside your coffee shop. Yeah, no thanks. Mm-hmm. I'd rather not. Because now everybody in the world has the potential to know that I was outside of that coffee shop, depending on your lack of security. Would everyone in the world care?
Well, I want to separate that out, though. I mean, I think you're right. We need to protect. That has to be. There should be strong laws, and you should get punished if you have data breaches. You need to have a higher duty of protecting that information. I agree with that. I stipulate that, but I want to separate that out from just geofenced ads.
I want the choice, and to say, should I opt into a geofenced ad? Yes, I want that choice. I want to say no or yay.
Okay.
And I want it to be an informed choice. And that's, I don't see that that's crazy.
No. So I think I agree. I don't love going into certain stores and getting notification after notification that's, you know, you can get 20% off here, 20% off there. Did you know that this is on sale? It gets very annoying, especially when I'm dealing with, you know, like at this point, I'm dealing with hundreds of notifications a day, and it's like highly distracting. And, you know, the opt-in thing is also, you know, something that I wish every time my phone updates, for some reason, all of the notifications that I've set like get erased, and I'm stuck back with all these banner ads. And it's a problem that plagues me. But I did want to talk just for a second about one of the researchers at Data and Society did this really cool project in 2013 where he target marketed Shaquille O'Neal specifically with a piece of artwork. And they were using, so they were calling it like this artisanal data mining project, and they had identified all of these.
I would think it'd be impossible because that's as an individual, as opposed to geofencing. So that's, I want to hear about this. That's interesting.
Yeah. So there's an article on Gizmodo called Bizarre New Art Project Stalks Shaquille O'Neal for Custom Dunk Rig. And so the idea behind it, and the artist is a researcher named Matt Gertzen at Data and Society. And so the idea was a bit of a lark, right? But they were like, if we can learn enough about Shaquille O'Neal, can we target market him? And then from proof of concept, sell this notion of data mining. And, you know, one of the things that we think about at Data and Society related to art is really about how these targeted art projects or these kind of like ambitious art projects that try to do one thing really well open up for us another way of thinking about technology. And so one of the things that Matt is very, very good at is thinking about, well, what is the constellation of things that we need to know about a person, place, or thing in order to grab the kind of keywords and to make the, you know, in order to get to the bottom of stuff. And so, it was a beautiful project. Unfortunately, Shaquille O'Neal didn't, come to them to buy this.
It didn't work.
It didn't work, but it.
Well, this would have been a lot more interesting if it had worked.
Well,
so a couple of problems here. First of all, the reason they target Shaq is because he's a sitting duck. He's, you know, unlike you and me, Stacey and Joan, he's got maybe me, but I mean, you could target Shaq because he's so public about everything. He's an avowed narcissist was one of the reasons. So they actually identified keywords. They bought this phrase Shaq is the best because it had a low search volume, probably most likely Shaq himself. So, I mean, this is something highly targeted and it didn't work. Or maybe Shaq was immune.
Or maybe he wasn't interested in the art once he saw it. But the point was, this is 2013, right? And we have artists showing us the...
I'm glad they said it was an art project anyway.
and how AdSense could be used. And I had remembered reading maybe a year and a half ago a 2600 magazine excerpt about someone that was targeting police departments with geofence data and advertising and trying to influence the kinds of advertising that police officers saw when they searched for things online. And so there are other kinds of targets that we might think about in terms of the way that this might play out, whether it's highly targeted marketing to certain celebrities in order to gain attention, or, you know, government buildings. I even heard, I don't know if it's true, I can't substantiate this, but I heard that someone had been targeting Donald Trump's set of phones because he uses a very particular older model Android phone when he's right. tweeting. And so they were using that kind of data to target market to that very specific level of the phone itself.
Well, he's almost certainly by now been hacked because he insists on using two older phones that are not secured in the White House. Mm-hmm. And we know, we talked last week about how many stingrays there are in the D.C. area.
Oh, goodness.
So it would be an easy thing to hack him. Mm. I will give you, Stacey, that you, everyone should have the right to turn off that location information and to say, don't follow me. And I think for the most part you do in most phones, you can say, don't track me to almost everything.
Yes,
right?
But you're giving up services like maps. I mean, if I want to know where I am in a city, I have to actually share this.
Can I point out the apps is a fabulous free product? And what you're saying is I want it, but I don't want to pay for it.
I would pay for it. I would pay for always on access to Google Maps and directions. Okay. Easily.
I mean, and that's the argument with Facebook, too, is that Facebook could offer an ad-free, location-free experience if they charged you. There's a couple of problems. One, it's anti-democratic. You'd have to be able to afford to spend hundreds of dollars a month on a variety of services that you get for free now. The other is that none of these services are built on that model, and that's maybe not as easy to do as it sounds to say, well, okay, well, let's put up a paywall. There's another problem, which is it's not just Google and Facebook. AT&T and Verizon both want to
set up
networks.
Yes, everybody's getting in on this. And I would also say let's also expose like the fact that we are being tracked. I could afford to pay for all of this. Thus, I am probably a more attractive target for a lot of ads. Whereas someone who can afford to pay for it probably is a less attractive target for certain ads. Not all ads, but so that's a, I don't know. It's like the insurance model meets the ad networks. It's gross. Gross, gross. Mm-hmm. So, okay.
Mm-hmm. So, all right, I will grant you. I think that would be a good goal is to have both disclosure and control. And that's, I think, GDPR's mission as well. I worry about unintended consequences. As I said, we're already seeing a huge drop in ad sales.
We can fix unintended consequences if we decide we don't like them. This is the same argument that people had in the U.S. about like healthcare, right? And now people are like, oh, wait, that was actually okay. We probably could fix a lot of things that weren't right about it.
Right.
But, you know, there's a whole entrenched lobby of people who pay to make sure that we don't think about this stuff.
Right.
So, sorry.
Good.
Okay. Are you yawning? Wait.
No, I'm agreeing with you.
No. Oh, I was like, how good is this coffee?
I needed some oxygen. I just need a little oxygen. That's all. Mm-hmm. I think we can pretty much wrap this up. Is there any other stories that we really want to mention today? I think we did a good job of covering Mary Meeker's slideshow. Samsung has to pay Apple $500 million, according to a jury, but it will be appealed. You see?
Wait, Samsung's getting to 3 nanometers? No way.
What? TechSpot.
No way.
TechSpot says.
All right.
So current Intel processors are at 14 nanometers.
Qualcomm has
some 10 nanometers.
Okay.
Nobody I think that I know of is going below 10, except Samsung is now saying that they can make processors, ARM-based processors, at 3. That's got to be. That's crazy. What? Not yet?
Not yet. This is a roadmap to
2019.
Yeah, this is so their next, no, in 2019, they're going to be using EUV lithography for 7 nanometers, which is really impressive.
Okay.
And
that's
tough because your yields go down tremendously, but they're targeting 4 nanometer low power early and low power plus. And 4 is the last generation to use FinFET, which is the differentials in.
Oh, it. It will be a few years before Samsung and any of its competitors are able to scale process technologies all the way down.
Yeah, so this is not real.
2022. So this
I don't
just,
believe it's real.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you can't.
What we don't know is what that will look like and whether quantum effects will make them completely useless because no.
It's not. Quantum computing? Because it's not quantum effects. Leakage is your big issue when you start cramming them that close together.
Leakage, but also I don't know. I'm not a physicist, but I thought that once you get to that scale that you are actually in the quantum realm, but maybe not.
I guess. I'm like, sure.
Electrons don't act as reliably.
Yeah, they don't
they
act
used
like
to.
They're supposed to.
I don't know. I'm not a physicist.
Multi-bridge channel FETs. Wow.
If you are in the UK and you're watching TV, especially if you're watching TV during Coronation Street or The Simpsons, you may be surprised you see a Samsung ad and your TV goes dark for 5 seconds. Oh, can you imagine the upset this is going to cause? The screens will, this is a Samsung ad. Screens will buzz with static interference before going blank and entirely silent for 5 seconds. That's enough time to freak out. The darkness ends with text emerging, which reads, "This is your TV screen most of the time. A void full of nothing." And then talks about the ambient mode in Samsung's QLED TVs, which means you'll never see a blank screen again.
You know, that was a big deal at Cydia last year. There were so many well-framed TVs that were very pretty. So at the high end, they are definitely pushing TVs that have
like digital art frames, kind of.
Yeah, well, yes, framed for digital arts, but also they're pretty TVs. And then, yes, they have whatever, if you want giant pictures, great. If not, you know.
Oh, I'd be so pissed off. I'd be so pissed off. 5 seconds is an infinitude. You mean you just assume, oh, my God, the cable's failed. Mm-hmm. Did you want to talk about, you want to put to rest, I did say we would talk about this. This Z-Wave, 100 million Z-Wave devices that are going to be hackable.
If we're all freaked out about it, just calm down, folks.
Calm the F down.
So what this is, it's a rehash of a hack that was in 2013. And I think again in 2016, we all discussed this and we're like, ah. So in April of 2017, the Z-Wave Alliance introduced a new concept called S2 security. So what this new hack does is it rolls back your S2 security to S0, which is the one that was hacked in 13 and 16. Now, a couple things to know about it. The hack itself is pretty tough. You've got to be within Z-Wave range. Which is like
Z-Wave range. You gotta be within Z-Wave range. Okay.
So yeah, you gotta be really close. Okay. And then you've got a very limited amount of time to catch it, much like if you're going trying to hack someone's Wi-Fi by sitting outside and trying to get their credentials and then cracking the credentials. This is a similar effort. So you've gotta be close. You've gotta catch it's not exactly a handoff, but you've gotta catch that. Then you can, in a secure S2 device, roll it back to S0 and try to hack it. But if you have S2 security on a device, it will actually notify the users when that security gets rolled back to S0. So the one thing that you might want to worry about, again, if you have someone who's really technically savvy trying to hack your particular door locks, is that not a lot of devices out on the market actually use S2 security yet. Oh, okay. August locks do, but not like a lot of smart home hubs don't. There's about 15 of them with S2, but some of the big ones like Wink and SmartThings don't yet. So that's kind of all you should really know about that. I have a lot of Z-Wave stuff. I'll just tell you, I'm not really worried. If you want to come in and break in my door locks, it's going to be so much easier just to break a window than to hack
mine. Right.
This is an issue if like you're...
Again, the argument.
If your hotel uses it.
Oh, yeah, that would be an issue. Absolutely. But this is the
argument. But a lot of hotels use Bluetooth.
You should only have, if you're going to have an automatic door lock, you should get one that is automatically updated. And presumably, would this would be software fixable, I presume?
This particular thing, I don't think it's software fixable. It's a fundamental, it is a fundamental flaw in Z-Wave. And yes, the Z-Wave Alliance does say that this was a conscious decision that they made that this should be allowed. I imagine it has to do with backwards compatibility because they're really sticklers about that. But, and again, S0 is the same. To hack at the S0 level, you have to be in physical proximity to the device. You have to have the same quick reaction, like quick grab of the handoff. So, again, there's a lot of easier ways from an individual level. If it's at a corporate or like a hotel, like a larger target, maybe it makes sense. So, but an individual, I wouldn't stress it.
Thank you for the clarification. Steve Gibson agrees with you. We talked about it yesterday as well.
Oh, man, we are just like on the same page this whole show.
Same wavelength.
Yeah.
Joan Donovan is at Data and Society, where you can read her great stuff, datasociety.net. She's a researcher in media manipulation. That never happens.
Like I said, business is booming. You know, it's a good time to be a researcher.
Fantastic.
If that's, you know, if you got to pay the bills.
Anything else you want to plug?
I guess, are we doing picks? You want me to?
Yeah, you want to do a pick? Let's do a pick.
Well, because I mentioned at the beginning, but I didn't mention her name. Virginia Eubanks is the one who wrote the book Automating Inequality, and I highly recommend it. Came out recently. She's been doing a bunch of book tours as well as doing the organizational circuit, like just really spreading the knowledge and the love around. And so it's a very well-written book, very easy to understand, and really gets to the heart of how inequality is going to show up in our, you know, online and high tech life. And I think it's really, you know, she spent years researching and working with people all over America to get the data. And so it's really rich storytelling, but also, I think that she, even though it took her a long time and she always felt like she was running behind, I think the time is now that people read that book.
Sounds like somebody we should get on Triangulation, Karsten. Make a note of it.
Brilliant.
Thank you, Joan. Great recommendation. Mm-hmm. Virginia Eubanks, Automating Inequality. Stacy, what are you looking at these days?
All right. I am following up on a pick because I gave you a headphone pick way back in, I don't know, November, December, after I bought these cheap, but, you know, perfectly serviceable wire Bluetooth headphones. They were like $30 Senso headphones.
Yes.
And they died.
Oh, no.
Which it was, they lasted about 6 months. So, you know, it's fair. But they are now dead. So I decided just to just go all in. It was Mother's Day. So I got the Jabra Elite 65T.
Oh, I have Jabras as well. I love them.
These are really good, you guys. They were $170. So Let's show you my headphones. I feel kind of silly, but
is the case. Good. They sound good too.
And I'll take one earphone out so you can see it in my ear. Let's get the right one. So this is the
itty bitty. They're black. The case is a charging case like the AirPods. You already have headphones in. Don't jam. Oh, okay.
So, and this is.
Look at that. That looks like a clever jewelry artifact. And Amazon Echo is built in. You can echo it.
I did not. So I have not put in the app because I need another app on my phone. Like I need a hole in my head. But here you are. They've lasted for me. I've had them about 2 weeks. They've lasted about a week with regular use, just charging, putting them back in the charging case and then charging them. They have, if I press it on this side, I can get access to Google Assistant or possibly Siri. I don't use them with an iPhone. And then they have fast forward, volume up controls on this ear. And they're really good. And I have really small ears and the smallest setting does work for me. So I don't know. I really like them so far.
Yeah, I have.
We'll see if they last longer than 6 months.
I have the Sport Elite and I imagine it's true with these as well. They come with so many different tips and they're really clear. You've got to get the tip that fits the best. for the best sound, but also in the Sport Elite for heart rate measurements. And so they do all, you have to shake your head. They have an app and you have to shake your head and go like this and this and make sure it's not going to fall out. And, but once you get the fit right, the sound quality is superb.
The sound quality is good. There's a 2-year dust and water resistance warranty. And they do actually touch with Madam A. I will have to check that out. And Siri, they sound good on calls. My other ones did not sound good when I was on phone calls, which is really important to me. My music sounds good. I can wear them during a sweaty workout. I've worn them a couple times during a sweaty workout and they're still alive. So I wouldn't say they're waterproof, but it's 100 degrees here. So they're definitely sweatproof. I am petrified about losing them. And yeah, I don't know how they relate to the iPod things, but I will say they have the one feature that the AirPods have that I really like is the, when you take them out of your ear, they're like, oh, we're no longer being used. So they pause the music and then they take it out.
Nice.
So
yeah.
And okay, that's all there is.
You said you agree with their 5-hour battery life. Is that about right?
I do. Well, yeah. I think because I've had them on a plane. So I wore them on the plane. I didn't realize I'm a space cadet, but I didn't put my noise canceling headphones on. I just left these in. And it was a 4.5-hour flight. So
close to
5. Yeah.
But you know, you don't need noise cancellation as much if they really isolate. And I think those
do. They really do. You cannot hear a lot. That is a downside that, and I don't know if they have like a true hear or some sort of like you can hear ambient noises, but I'm okay with that.
Yeah, I don't want to hear ambient noises on the plane. If we're going down, I don't need to know. It's okay.
Oh, people are asking me about the Wyze camera on the thing. So can I give you a second pick?
Yeah. Because
it's really cute.
Good. Yes.
So Wyze Cam, I think it's WYZECam.com. Let's see.
WYZECam.com. Yes.
Yeah. So they just launched today. The Pan Cam, a $30 Pan Cam.
No.
I know.
What?
I ordered one because for $30, why wouldn't you order this thing?
What?
I know. The horizontal range, horizontal this way is 360. So, and vertical is just 93 degrees, but that's, you know, pretty good.
And it has a patrol route.
Yeah. And the Wyze Cam itself is really good. The $20 HD Wyze Cam, Kevin actually reviewed it on our site, and I used to have the version 1 of it. I love these things. They're pretty sweet.
Oh, and and it can tag animals. Look at, see, it sees the dog. Oh, this is really neat.
$30. It's a company that's founded by people from Amazon. It's hosted on AWS. The software is built in the US. The hardware is made in China. So they license hardware from a Chinese camera maker. They say that all the data goes to you. I don't know. You can store it on an SD card if you would like.
Free rolling 14-day cloud storage. You don't even have to subscribe.
Right. Yes, there's lots of things.
What? Oh no, I'm buying it before they're sold out. How can they do this, Stacy?
So they talk to me because they basically say their model is just like Amazon's business model, which is razor thin margins that, you know, you make up for by selling a butt ton of devices. I don't know if this is really a credible business model, but this is what they're doing.
I thought they must be making it up in subscriptions. Wow, I'm buying 3 right now.
Dear Lord. Why buy 3? It pans all around the room, Leo.
But I have 3 rooms. I have several rooms in my home.
You don't want to put it in your bedroom.
You're right.
Okay. Don't do that.
Right.
Or your bathroom.
You're right.
Don't do that to us. What a nice like treat for any hacker who hacks into your camera. You're like,
Can you? Is it like pan, tilt, zoom that you control or?
Through the app, it looks like it. Yes, I don't have it yet.
But you can set it up for a patrol, so it can look there, stay there for a few seconds, look there, up to 4 points, and then go back. Mm-hmm. Wow! Wow! At that price, buy a dozen. All right, so we'll have your review when you get yours. Very nice. Yeah, it says you can pan, tilt, and zoom in the Wyze app. Up to for 360-degree live view, up to 110 degrees a second. 3 seconds, in other words, to go all the way around. Wow.
And I should tell you, I should clarify for you guys, when I talk to the founders at Wise, they're saying their contention is that you could make a Nest Cam with the $30 bomb that they've got, basically. And
that just shows
Nest
you
is just
what the markup is.
Doesn't. So well, I don't know how much, you know, material costs there are in the Nest. So I can't verify that statement. But that's what they're touting.
They're putting their money where their mouth is. They're selling this thing for $30 with no subscription.
And I've read their terms of service. They're not like pulling your camera
Wait
data.
A minute. What is this? This is the Wise Cam 2.
Oh, yeah, that's the original Wise Cam.
Oh, this is the original one.
I don't know if it's the original. They look the same.
It's the second one.
It's not the new one, though.
The new one's called the Go or the Pan. So this doesn't pan. It just sits there. And how much was this?
$20.
$20.
That's the what Kevin reviewed. Yeah.
So I could just put this on my head.
We had ours by our fish tank for a while just to see if they didn't die like we were on vacation.
Right. And did they?
No.
How about the camera? Did it die?
It did not die.
Well, that's impressive. Are we reviewing this? Is that why we already did? Who did it? Megan on the new screensavers. Oh, I did. I remember that. Yeah. I wasn't here.
And okay. You can send people to Stacy on IoT to Kevin's review if you want that camera.
StacyOnIoT.com. Read Kevin Toefel's thorough, in-depth review of the Wise Cam 2. And stay tuned. Sometime in the next few weeks, Stacy and I will have our Wise Cam pans. We can have dueling panos.
Pan cam.
Stacy Higginbotham is at StacyOnIoT.com. That's where she hangs her hat. And she does a great podcast with Kevin Toefel at GigaStacy on the Twitter. We do this show every Wednesday, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC. If you want to tune in and join us, we'd love it. You can watch at twit.tv/live, chat in the chat room at irc.twit.tv. Join us in studio by emailing tickets at twit.tv. Tickets are always free. But of course, if you can't do any of that, on-demand audio and video of every show. Available on our website, twit.tv/twig for this particular show. Or subscribe and get it each and every week the minute it's available. Hot off the presses. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. And we'll see you next time on Twig. Bye-bye.